preface my remarks by saying to you that when I use this word I a lot, just disregard it, because this, you can't do it. I happen to be a party to this thing, this experience, so I'm sharing these ideas and disregard the personality in connection with it. This is going back as a start 54 years ago at the start, and then 43 years ago of this pilgrimage to Haifa in 1921. And I think you'll see as I tell this story that it parallels your own experience in many cases. We have all come out of various environments, backgrounds, from which we've had to disencumber ourselves of preconceived ideas and things of that kind. And it's the cause of the Baha'u'llah that has made it possible for us to escape this environment and disencumber ourselves from these things. Fortunately, I had a very wonderful mother and father, which I'm very grateful to the fact that they were my mother and father. My mother, when she started out as a young lady, said that having come from an Orthodox background, Baptist background, determined that her children are not going to be raised with this dogma and superstition and fanaticism that was taught in her day. So she said when she started, when we were children, she said, now, she knew the value of religion, but she didn't know the actual facts of it like no one else did at that time. But she knew that it was necessary to go to some Sunday school, so she said, you boys will have to go to some Sunday school. You can choose whatever you want to go to. Well, she says, remember, you don't have to swallow everything that's told to you, which is a good start out. And then, naturally, because mother's background was Baptist, we as a boy chose the Baptist Sunday school. I wasn't there 6 months till I met another young boy in Congregational Sunday school. And he said, why don't you come over to our Sunday school? We have a very nice ministry, plays baseball with us. And on Christmas, he gives us Christmas presents. So I joined the Congregational Sunday school. Well, I ran the gamut from that start to everything. Christian Science, New Thought, Theosophy, Unitarianism, the Ouija board, many other things. And the Ouija board, just a humorous story, we were in San Diego, California a number of years ago with a friend of mine. There were several other boys there, and we wanted to experiment with table lifting. So we were sitting upstairs in the dark room. We'd been sitting there half an hour expecting this table to rise if we got in the right spirit. Well, the mother of my friend was objected to this sort of thing, and she quietly sneaked up the back stairs and didn't let us know, and was in a dark room. And she opened the door, she let out a war whoop. Well, the table went through the ceiling. And when the lights were turned on, several of them were sitting back there with glassy eyes. Well, my mother was a very dear friend of Mrs. Latimer, George Latimer. Many of you know George Latimer. He was one of the early believers who traveled across in the early days to meet Abdul Ha, and wrote many articles that are published in our Baha'i magazine and other pamphlets that they issued with Harry Rand and others. And Mrs. Latimer and my mother were members of several clubs in Portland, Oregon. My mother was president of the Brownie Society there, and Mrs. Latimer was also active in several other things. And every time Mrs. Latimer would get together with my mother, she'd talk about the Baha'i movement. And they had very brief information about who Abdul Baha was in that day. They used to refer to him many times as a great philosopher in Persia, in the Holy Land. And they referred to the Baha'i faith as the Baha'i movement in those days. So Mrs. Latimer would give Mother some little excerpt that had been typed up in New York from Roy Wilhelm. And others sent around. They had very little literature. We had the hidden words, one or two other items. And Mother would bring this material home to the family, to try it out on the family. Well, every time she'd give me an excerpt from the hidden word or something like that, since I had gotten away from religion, well, I forgot to tell you that after I had gone all these places, I finally adopted my father's point of view. He said, now, Curtis, he said, you don't have to go to any Sunday school or anything else to be a first-class citizen or straightforward in your life. He says, all you have to do is make up your mind to be honest and have integrity in those qualities. You don't have to go anywhere to have anybody tell you to do that. So this sounded pretty good because he didn't go to any church. And he was a man of the highest principles of integrity and so forth. So this sounded pretty good, so I had dropped out of religion. So after my mother would bring these things home to the house, she'd ask me to read it, and I'd say, well, Mother, this is very beautiful. You know, I'm not interested in religion anymore. And I'd hand it back to her. Well, this went on for a little while, and then we had moved to Tacoma, Washington. One day my mother said to me, I want you to stay home today because I'm having Mr. Wilhelm is going to be here in Tacoma. We had moved to Tacoma, Washington, and I want you to come and hear him speak. He's going to speak on the Baha'i movement. Well, I said, well, Mother, I'm still not interested in religion. I don't want to hear him. Well, I stayed home that day anyway, but I didn't go to hear Mr. Wilhelm. I went down in the basement to work in the woodworking shop. And there was only one entrance out of the basement, and I heard my mother talking to Roy in the kitchen. She says, Roy, Mr. Wilhelm, I want you to get down in the basement and tell Curtis about the Baha'i movement. So I knew I couldn't get out of the basement, except I threw a door, so I was all fine for Roy when he came downstairs. But he came down the stairs, and he didn't say a word about the movement. He began to inquire about, this is a good point in teaching. He came downstairs and he talked about the woodwork shop. I had a bandsaw, a lathe, and a circular saw, and things like that. I was making some furniture. And he made inquiry about everything I was doing in that shop. He became extremely interested in this woodworking shop. So I looked at him and I said, well, here's a guy that's not all cracked up in religion. And I struck up immediately a friendship with Mr. Wilhelm, which lasted until his passing in 1950. Then he said, Mr. Kelsey, he said, I have a home in West Englewood, New Jersey, and he said, I'd like to have a shop of this kind. If you ever come to New York, he said, I wish you'd come out and help me set up a shop of this kind. Well, I had no idea to go to New York, and I said, well, I'd like very much to do that for you, but I don't see any chance of mine going to New York. Well, he said, you never know about those things. I thought it was a kind of funny remark to give, but I said, well, I might not know about it, but I don't see the opportunity to do it. But if I do, I'll certainly be glad to come see you. Several weeks after he left, my father transferred his business to New York City. And I went off to Detroit, Michigan. I had been working for Ford Motor Company, and I went off to Detroit, Michigan to work for Ford in toolmaking. I had been there for a couple of weeks, and I knew I had to have some social contact, so I again went back to the Unitarian Church, because there you could join that, you could believe what you please. And after several weeks at the Unitarian Church, the minister announced, anyone who would like to stay after the service to hear a Persian speak, and when he mentioned Persian, my ears stood up, and he said, he's going to talk on the Baha'i movement. Now this shows how things tie in. And I decided I was going to stay. I was curious to see what this was going to be. And after the service was over, the church emptied out. One other man stayed and myself. And the minister came down and he introduced us to Dr. Zia Baghdadi, a very well-known believer, very dynamic personality. And then the minister came over and he apologized. He said he had had an appointment, so only the three of us were left in the church. Dr. Baghdadi, being the person he was, got up on the pulpit and he talked as if that church was full. I don't remember what he said. I was just keenly interested and the curious about a man talking about the Baha'i movement. Then several weeks passed and my father wrote to me from New York. He said, I want you to come east and visit the family. So I said, all right, I'll do that. It was around Christmas season. And I made arrangements to go, and my foreman came to me. He said, Kelsey, he says, you'll have to give up your vacation this time. I said, I'm sorry, Mr. Pulaski, because I already made appointments to go to New York and I can't change my plans. Well, he said, you'll have to change your plans. I said, there's no such thing as after. I've made five plans to go to New York. Well, he said, if you do that, he said, you won't get $5 outside the Ford Motor Company. That's when Ford had paid the $5 a day program that was supposed to upset the economy of this country, you know. And they had a welfare board at that time, which you had to account to the Ford Motor Company for the way you spent $2.50 of your $5. The welfare man came around about every 3 months. It had to be spent on furniture, clothing, something worthwhile. Otherwise, you'd be docked in your salary. Well, when he told me that I couldn't get that money outside, and being a young man, and the world is your own at that time, you know, I said, well, now that's settled. If you can give me my time, I'm quitting. Oh, no, no, he said, you can't do that, because he had to go and explain to the welfare board why I was leaving such a good job. It took me 8 hours to get out of Ford Motor Company. But I went on to New York, and I went to work for my father in the contracting business, and I stayed with that business until 1959, so, and much more money than I was getting with Ford Motor Company. I had been home about 2 weeks with the family, and I came down with typhoid fever. and you have a very severe headache with typhoid fever. And my mother had, we were living in Van Cortlandt Park at the time, my mother made me as comfortable as she could one night with ice packs on my head to stop this pain. And when she went to bed, it was so bad that I turned over in the bed and was pushing my head in the pillow to try to relieve the thumping and the pressure. And as I did so, I heard behind me a full-piece orchestra. There weren't any physical instruments in the room, but it was as if they were there, and beautiful music. And I swung around because I never had any experience like this, and the pain stopped instantly. And then we turned around as if the music floated away. And I called my mother, and she came running in thinking something had happened to me. And she found me sitting up in bed. When I told her the experience I had, she went and got the Baha'i books. We sat up the rest of the night looking at this literature, and I wasn't looking at the literature but what was in the Baha'i. I was looking because she said there must be an answer to this experience in the Baha'i teachings. And as I read it, began to read these things, I said, well, Mother, you should have shown this to me before. This is wonderful. This is true. She said, I've been trying to tell you this for 9 years, but you wouldn't pay attention. So for the next 2 weeks, I think there was every Baha'i in New York came into the houses. Howard Ives, Mr. Hooper Harris, Mary Hanford Ford, Mrs. Krug, and a whole host of other believers came into the house, sat on the bedside, and they'd bring books, and they'd try to find the answer to this experience, but they couldn't find it. And then the war came on, and I went to the First World War, and I took along an extra gas mask case with me, the Hidden Wars, and another book to take with me. I thought it was a very easy matter to tell the soldiers in the company about the faith, but I soon found out that I was pretty well put in my place trying to tell them about the faith. But I met one young man who became quite interested, and then our life was separated through the war. And when I was sitting in the restaurant in Paris later on, I looked up, and here was this young man I'd given the message to, and he came over across, and we met in the middle of the dining room. And the first question he asked me, he says, I want to know more about the Baha'i movement. So there was one man at that time. Well, I came home from the war, and one day I was down in Wall Street talking with Mr. Wilhelm. And he said, how would you like to go to Haifa? I said, I'd like nothing better, but I don't see any chance of my going to Haifa. And then he gave me the same coffee thing. He said, you never know about those things. And I left. We parted. We'd gone to lunch together. He was, Mr. Wilhelm's office at 104 Wall Street was the one place that all the cables and the letters with the massive transfer wrote to the friends in America came through Mr. Wilhelm's office in those days. It was a very interesting office. And I later, this is why he was working on it. So I passed it off. I said, I'd like nothing better than go. And about 2 weeks after that, 3 weeks after that, along comes a cablegram from Abdul Hall. And all it said on it, Curtis Kelsey permitted. And with it, I got the strongest impression I had to act on that at once and get there as quickly as possible. And I set up about 25 days to get there. And the money. What to do about the money? I knew my father wouldn't consent to this. He would think I was losing my mind. He wasn't a Baha'i, but he wasn't opposed to the faith. So I set about to get the money myself. I'd been working in the grocery store on weekends, and I went down to New Rochelle at the time to where I'd been working with one of the boys around 6 o'clock, and I walked in and I said, which one of you fellows like to buy my Ford? I had a Ford Model T Ford. And they looked, it was a busy hour, and they looked kind of sheepish at that time. I didn't say anything. I felt kind of sheepish and started to walk out. Well, one of them ran after me and says, wait a minute, Kurt. He says, if this car of yours will climb a certain hill here, I'll give you $150 for it. And since I just cleaned the spark plugs that afternoon, we went over the hill and high, and I had $150. Then I sold a few other items. I got $200 or $300 together. I went down one day to see Roy again. And he said, how are you making out on your trip to Haifa? And I said, I'm doing very well, but not well enough. He said, well, how would $500 help? And he gave me $500. So now I had enough money to make the trip to Haifa. So I said, I better go and see my father. Now, this is the next hurdle. So I went to see my father. He's in Woolworth Building, man. And I told my dad what I was going to do. And he said, you must be losing your mind. He says, here you are, a young man, going halfway around the world, and you're going over to do this work for this little old man over there, and they're not even going to pay you for it? He didn't know who Abdul Baha was. And I said, well, Dad, I haven't time to explain to you, but I simply have got to make this trip. Well, he says, if you're going, he says, don't expect any help from me. And I said, as long as you don't object, I'm going ahead with the plans. He says, it's all right, but don't expect any help from me. I don't agree to such a thing. So I went ahead. went down and inquired about passage, and I found that I couldn't get passage as quick as I wanted to Haifa. So I said, well, give me a ticket to Paris, to Naples, to Brindisi, to Alexandria, to Carpen, up to Haifa. So I got this ticket. And down at the steamship, there were many of the New York friends came down with letters to the master and other little gifts. And my mother and father were there within the audience. And my mother got me a Graflex camera and some film. And my father came over and he handed me an envelope. He said, you can open this when you get on the boat. When I opened it, it was $250 in it. It wasn't going to help. Well, on to Paris. When I got to Paris, I made inquiry about sailings out of Naples and nothing doing. There wasn't any sailing out of Europe for Naples for 2 weeks. And he said, why don't you stay in Paris? It's much more fun in Paris than it is in Naples. And I said, no thanks, I'm going on to Naples. And I went on down to Naples, and sure enough, there was no boat sailing for 2 or 3 weeks, he said. So I said to the man at the steamship office, I'll come in and see you tomorrow, because I'm sure something's going to happen. And he said, no, he says, don't do that. He says, we know our business. In case something happens, which won't happen, he said, I'll call you up. Where are you staying? So I gave him the hotel, and I went back to the hotel. That satisfied me. And that evening, the phone rang, and I was called to the phone, the steamship office. He says, how did you know the Hesperia was going to dock here? I said, I didn't know it was going to dock here. He says, well, they docked here to let off a sick passenger. Do you want his passenger? I said, yes. And the next morning, I was on the way from Naples to Alexandria. And I was out playing shuffleboard the next morning on the boat, and a man came over to me and introduced himself. He was Charles Dana, head of the American missionary work in the Near East. He had to do with the spending of funds to make the missionary work. And he inquired, he wanted who this young man was going over to the Near East, and he inquired, and I told him I was going to see, I used the title, Sir Abbas Effendi. And he said, well, I know some high youth at the University of Beirut, and they're very fine young men. But he said, the thing that puzzles me is that I don't understand how they're able to get so many Mohammedans to accept Jesus Christ. He says, what do you think about that? And I says, well, one thing I think about that, Mr. Dana, is that the Baha'is do not tear down the life of Muhammad. They accept Muhammad the same as they accept Jesus Christ. He scratched his head for a minute. He didn't say anything, not a little bit. He said, do you mind if I go with you to Haifa? So I said, no, and we were companions through Cairo and on to Haifa, and he went up to visit the Shrine of the Bab and then went on to Beirut. I never heard of him after that. Well, when we landed in Haifa, down at the railroad station was Dr. Latul Hakim and Khosro and Fujita. I have a picture of these two other friends that I'll show you afterwards. And they were down there with Abu Bahar's high buckboard wagon, and they drove up. We drove from the railroad station up to the Pilgrim House. And when we arrived at the Pilgrim House, there was Enos Graven, Mrs. Cook at that time, and her sister Indy Haggerty, and Madame Stannard, a woman from the East, a very wonderful Baha'i teacher from the East. And we were just past the time of the day when out from the room in the side of the Pilgrim House stepped Abu Bahar in his beautiful cream-colored robes and his white turban, and the hair flowing to his shoulders, and he smiled, and he says, Mahabar, Mahabar, you're welcome, you're welcome. And then Fujita had just set the table, and on the table was a big bowl of plow with curried lamb and orange peel and candied orange peel and saffron over it. And there were bowls of must around the table, like our yogurt and chopped greens and little glasses of teas, which they don't have at Haifa today, do they, Jiru? It was a very beautifully set table. And then the master set us all down. He usually sat at the head of the table. I sat on this side, and Madam Stannard sat here, and Mrs. Cook and her sister there. And when he sat down, he looked over at me, and he said, did you notice how easy it was for you to come here? And I realized I had reached Haifa in the time that I had allotted for myself when I received that cable card. Every obstacle was removed. The master always washed his hands and rest out his mouth before he ate the table. Fujita would bring him a pan of water and he'd wash his hands before he'd eat. And because sometimes we'd eat fish and he'd eat fish with his fingers, and he said fingers were made before forks. Well, we had lunch and then he bid us rest for the afternoon, and he had one of the boys bring in a brass of tangerines on a brass. You've seen that. Into the room, and then for many days after that, we had lunch, an evening meal to that hall, and come over to the Western Pilgrim House. About 15 days went by, and I hadn't been able to get started on wiring the shrine for which I'd come over there. Now, the reason Mr. Wilhelm had asked me if I wanted to go to Haifa was that sometime before he had spoken to me, he had read a tablet of Abdu'l-Bahá's in which Abdu'l-Bahá had spoken about the life of the Bab in the fortress of Shariq, in which he didn't even have a candlelight. And he mentions the whole world is flooded with light, and they're waiting for the one who in prison who doesn't even have a candlelight. And this so impressed Roy that he wrote over to Abdu'l-Bahá and asked if he couldn't send a lighting plant over to light the shrine of the Bab. And Abdu'l-Bahá wrote back, yes, you can send three. And Roy, being the kind of a Baha'i he was, he sent the three light plants over to Haifa. One was for the home of the Master, one for the shrine of Baha'u'llah, and one for the shrine on Mount Carmel. So 15 days had gone by, and Abdu'l-Bahá hadn't said anything about starting the work. And I knew I didn't dare go ask him, because I knew instinctively he knew when to start, and he was very aware of what was going on, which I found out many times. And so after 15 days, I began to be quite concerned. So I thought, well, I'll ask somebody else. So I asked his grandson, Rui Atman, who we were standing out in front of the master's home, and it's quite a distance from the center of the road through that stone gate to the front porch. You know the distance there. You're quite a distance. And Abdu'l-Bahá wasn't anywhere around, and I said to Rui, when do you think the master's going to let me start this work? And he hadn't any sooner said that, and Abdu'l-Bahá came out on the porch, and he says, we will start tomorrow. And he smiled and back in the room. Well, I was delighted that we were going to start the work tomorrow. So the next morning, before Dr. Latpula, Hakima, and Fujita and I could get out of bed, there stood the master in our doorway of our bedroom. And the corner of the room was on this side, faced the room. My bed is in that corner, and Dr. Latpula is in this corner, and Fujita in the other corner. And the master opened the door and stood there. It was about 6 o'clock in the morning. And we all made a big move, a quick move to get up, and he said, no rest. And then he turned to me and he said, I can't go to Akadei. What shall I do about it? And instantly I said to the master, when the master is ready, I'm ready. And he said, Bali, and walked out. Well, I was disappointed that we weren't going to start that day, but that afternoon about 4 o'clock he sent word over to the pilgrim house to get ready. We were going over to Akadei to start the lighting plants. So around 4:30, down to the railroad station we went, and Haifa in those days was just like it had remained for centuries, a little village, and the railroad station had palm trees around it. They used to bring their candles in there and tie them to the palm trees. And the Arabs used to come in there, and it was a little narrow gauge Turkish railroad that went over from Haifa to Akka, went over in the evening and came back in the morning. So down to the railroad station we went, and instead of Abdu'l-Bahá getting on the train, he sat down in the railroad station. And I remember the conductor was so concerned because he wanted to start, but he knew he couldn't start that train until Abdu'l-Bahá got on it. And I saw him take his watch out 2 or 3 times, but he had to have Abdu'l-Bahá on before he could get off of that train. Well, pretty soon an Arab came in and he tied his camel to the palm tree, and he went into the station and had a visit with Abdu'l-Bahá. After this short visit, then Abdu'l-Bahá came out and got on the train, and off we go to Akka. Well, the train stopped a short distance out from the city of Akka those days, and you had to be in Akka before sun went down, or they closed the gates to the city, and you'd have to stay out in the plain. Now, the plains surrounding Akka in those days were like the desert. They were, at night when the sun went down, you'd hear the coyotes howl after the sun went down. We weren't going into Akka, we were going inland to the Badji, about 2.5 miles. Well, Abdu'l-Bahá again sat down in the station, and Rui Atman and I stood outside waiting for him. And the sun went down, and up comes a full moon, and it was a beautiful night with white clouds floating by. And pretty soon I see an Arab with a black abar coming over and a black turban around with a cord around his head and draping over his shoulders. And he came into the station, and he had a conversation. And then in the meantime, coming through the dust was Khalid, a boy living in Cairo at the Badji, and he was leading Abdu'l-Bahá's white donkey. And he came over where Rui and I were standing, and as soon as Abdu'l-Bahá had this conversation, he came out and he got on the white donkey, and then Rui and I walked alongside him. I walked on the right and Rui Atman on the left. As we walked along through the moonlight, Abdu'l-Bahá said, beautiful night, beautiful sky, beautiful moon. And then he said, are you finding it difficult to walk? And I said, of course, I wasn't even thinking about walking, going along there. I was so glad to be alongside Abdu'l-Bahá. Well, we made the distance to the Badji, and at that time the mansion was not in our possession. It was in the possession of the half-brother of Abdu'l-Bahá, and we had the corner building where Abdu'l-Bahá used to go, and there were 2 bedrooms off, and there was a large room as you entered through the front door And back of it was a little garden with an orange tree, and off the right, a kitchen where they cooked the food on charcoal. And Kosho had gone on ahead, and he had prepared dinner again. So here was his table set with a large bowl of plow, as I had described before, and bowls of musk, and beautiful grapes, the bunches of Damascus grapes, and Persian melon on the table. And Abraham just commented upon these grapes. These are grapes, he says, you don't get anywhere else. They were very thin skin. You could eat the whole fruit. It was so tender. And as he was commenting on the grapes, someone rattled the door and had a crossbar on it. And he said, Bismillah, I'll be farmy. And Kosso ran across and opened the door, and there stood a 6'2" or 6'3" Arab, stood there grinning with his hand pulled across it. He stood right at the threshold, and Abraham repeated to him again, Bismillah, I'll be farmy. And he came across the threshold, and Abu Hawk sat him at the right-hand side of the table. And then they began a conversation in Arabic, and Abu Hawk pushed his turban back on his head, and to see the master laugh is certainly one of the wonderful pleasures, to see the laughter of the master, and the interest he had, and this Arab was laughing, and Ruli Arafan was laughing, and I was laughing even though I didn't hear what they were saying. And then pretty soon Ruli Arafan turned to me and he said, this is what was going on. It seemed the master had said to this Arab, isn't there a tradition in your tribe if the father hasn't stolen something, he can't come in the tent? His wife won't let him come in the tent at night. And the Arab said, yes, this is true. And then Abraham says, well, have you ever been kept out of the tent? He said, no, he had never been kept out of the tent. It seemed somebody had been stealing Abraham's sweet oranges. So then Abraham asked him if he liked sour oranges, and the Arab said, no, he didn't like sour oranges. Well, Abraham says, they taste very good with sugar on them. 2 days later, the Arab began to steal Abraham's sour oranges. Well, the next morning, Abdullah said we were going into the near the property by the shrine to talk about where we'd put the lighting plant up. And he had an elderly gentleman there, his name skipped me for this time, a man who had been with Baha'u'llah in prison, who was a mason, another man who was a carpenter. And he said, these two men will assist you in setting up the lighting plant and other things. And by the way, I have to go back to tell you, Mrs. Goodall had sent a young man from the Boston Magneto Works in the early days over to send those light plants, and Adelhaus sent him back. He was not a Baha'i, and Adelhaus sent him back. Hossein Karabai came from Persia, and Hossein Karabai means Hossein the electrician. And Adelhaus sent him back and said when the time comes, he can come and help. So when I arrived, Hossein was there. So Hossein and I went with the master into the garden back of the shrine of Baha'u'llah, and he asked me where I should set up the lighting plant, and I pointed out a place would be accessible to the shrine of Baha'u'llah. And he said, very well, use your judgment on it. And then he said, these two men will help you with anything you need. And then he asked me if I would turn on the light and work on the plants so that they could be turned on at the same time. The one on Mount Carmel and the one at the Shrine of the Bab be finished so the light would go on at the same time. And then we went into the Shrine of Baha'u'llah, and Abraham stood at the threshold of the Shrine of Baha'u'llah, and Ruli Arafan and I behind him, and there he chanted the Tablet of Visitation, a thing, an experience I'll never forget forever. And then after we finished the tablet of chanting the tablet, he turned to us and he said he wanted all the things in the shrine of Baha'u'llah to be taken out, and we were going to take them into the house of Abud at Akka. And of course we at that time didn't know why this was being done. Later I'll tell you why this happened. So we drove into the house of Abud, and there we had dinner. And while dinner was at dinner time, into the home came the chief of the Druids and his two sons. The father was in his 90s. And all during the dinner, this father was weeping, and the master was trying to comfort him. And I think this man sensed that this was the last time he'd see Abdul Baha, and anything Abdul Baha said to him didn't comfort him. But he would talk gently to him and tell him different things about the faith and things like that. And then afterwards, when it dismissed, we and finished our dinner, then we rode back to Haifa by the way of the sea in this high buckboard wagon. You'll see a picture of that here. Halfway back, there was a beautiful sunset over Mount Carmel. And I asked Abdul Baha if we could stop, and took this picture, and it's one of the beautiful pictures that's going everywhere, this sunset over Mount Carmel. And then we got back to Haifa, and I would spend 2 weeks in Haifa working there on Mount Carmel. Then I'd go over to Badji and work 2 weeks there to follow out the master's command to bring up the lighting plants at the same time. And every day at noon, when I'd be in Haifa, the master insisted on coming to lunch over there. And there'd be sometimes one or two pilgrims, sometimes just myself and Fujita, and sometimes Rui Akhner. But the master would bring his newspapers and his mail, and the master had a brown cat, which Fujita took care of. And Fujita and I would hide it every day, just to hear Abu Hossein let the cat out. And when we let the cat out, it would run across the room and rub up against his feet. And as the master would sit down by the side of the table, he'd read his mail, he'd feed the cat from the table. And I was stood there and sat there in astonishment many times, looking at this glorious figure of the master and the simplicity and wholesomeness of this life before me of the beloved master, and see how there was a calmness in the presence of the master that is indescribable. You sensed that you weren't worthy to be there, but he made you so at home that you could be in confidence. This is the beloved guardian did the same thing. Well, one day I thought I'd get a very quick answer from Abdu'l Baha on immortality. So I said to Abdu'l Baha, what's the difference in the life of the cat and the life of me? And he gave me a short talk on how we eat food. Now you might not think this applies, but you'll see that it does. And he described how the food went through all the organs of the body, and the essence of the food purified the body and strengthened the body, and that was of no bad that was left behind. And I thought, well, this doesn't answer immortality. But when I began to study the kingdoms, the four kingdoms, and I saw this progressive step in the kingdoms, I saw this was an answer to immortality. But then he got up and he walked across the floor, and in the old pilgrim house, which is down at the left-hand side, foot of Persian Street, living room had a slate floor, 9-inch squares. And as he got up and walked across the floor, one of these slates was loose and his foot struck it and it made a little noise. And he turned around and looked at it and he pointed to it and he said, it is progressing and it is possible for it to reach the stage of a mirror, a human temple. It shows how the elements can evolve into the human form. So that shows us the humility we should have and what we sit on even. All the elements that were in everything has the possibility of disintegration and through composition and evolution can pass into all kinds of forms. This is the immortality of this element. Well, years later I found much more on that subject, but this answered very definitely the question for me. Then we would, one day he said to us, now tomorrow an American lady is coming here and I don't want anything said to her about the Baha'i teaching. So sure enough, the boat docked the next day, and this American lady came up to the pilgrim house, and Abdu'l Baha sat at the right-hand side of the table, and she began to tell the master who he was. He was Elijah, he was this, and he was everything else. She had him all wrapped up in everything. And he just nodded at every statement she made. He just nodded her. He never talked, he just nodded her statements. She had a nice dinner. And after the dinner was over, she asked if she could have a private interview with Abdu'l Baha, and he said yes, she could, and she walked over to the house with him. And we didn't see her again. But 2 days later, Mrs. White, who was the one who challenged the will of the master, arrived at Haifa. And one day she came home while we were up there, came up to the pilgrim house, and she was all excited. She came over to Abdu'l Baha, and she said, oh, I met an American lady down at the hotel, and she was so interested, I had to tell her about the Baha'i faith and the Baha'i movement. And Abdu'l Baha said, did she ask you for money? And Mrs. White says, yes, how did you know? Well, I saw this lady 2 days ago, and she asked me for money, too. And Mr. Abdu'l Baha said, how much did you give her? She says, well, she told me a hard luck story that she was stranded in the East, and she needed about $100 to get back to America, and I let her have $100. Well, Abdu'l Baha said, had you obeyed my instructions, you would still have your $100. He had given her money, too. So this showed, and later on, shortly after that, the master, her government is over, and the master sent her away. And 2 days after her leaving there, she had reached Cairo was when the master passed. She came rushing back, disappointed that the master hadn't let her stay to witness his passing. You see, this is all a personal anger. Well, let's see, there's so many things. I'm trying to think of the different things. There's so many things that happened there in Haifa. We used to meet every evening with Abdu'l Baha in his home on the right room as you enter the front of Master's house. The right room was the room where Master met with the men. And there were many at that time, many of the older believers who had been in prison with Baha'u'llah, and they sat around the wall, and they would never speak unless the master addressed them directly. And he would tell the stories of the cause, the history of the cause, and then he would tell humorous stories. They would laugh, and many of these times. And I was there every evening when that went on, but it was always usually in Arabic or Persian. Getting time? All right, good. I haven't begun to tell you half of it, but if I want to go into some of the others, you'll have to continue it then. It's a quarter out, so he said he wants to stop promptly at quarter out. Well, I'll end with this one story, and then we can continue it another time. But because there are many, many things I'd like to share with you that show you this close connection that you all have with the Master. So, after many evenings sitting there in this room with the Master, he always sat in the corner of the room. There's a night when you sit in the corner, you can survey the whole room. And the Master would talk from the corner of the room, and I sat on the side of the wall. And one evening he turned over to me and said, "Do you understand what's being said here?" And I said, "No, Master, I don't, because it's in Persian or Arabic, and I don't understand these languages." So he said, "Well, your heart does. And the language of the heart is much more important than the language of words." So you see, you can be with a person. There's communication between people. It doesn't take words. I rode one whole afternoon with a man. He never said a word, taking him out in the automobile. But I can assure you there was communication. There was a warmth. There was an understanding. Well, friends, there are many other things I could share with you, but we have to be prompt. Yes, they were blue. And they, at times there was a luminous ring around his eyes. And he looked at you. I tell you many things about that, but we have to stop.